Our main speaker is Larry King.
Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Frank for asking me to come share with you at this meeting. And I'm glad to be sober. And I always haven't been that way. I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, I think. I'm sure of that. My sponsor has told me that I'm living proof that you can stay sober for 10 years and not amount to a damn thing, you know? I rode over with Ray M. and my sponsor Johnny over here, and they were supposed to comfort me on the way over here. And I tell you, it was kind of like asking Charlie Manson and Jeffrey Dahmer to give me a massage and haircut, you know? It's just one of the longest rides I've ever had in my life, you know? And if you're new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to remind you that you have a lethal, deadly, deadly illness. However, the treatment for this thing somehow is covered up with so much carnival and pomp, sometimes we don't know how serious this thing is. And I've been sober since May 2nd, 1982. And I'm here because my way don't work. In or out of Alcoholics Anonymous, drunk or sober, my way of living doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And I don't care how sober I get, I'll never be too sober not to drink. I'll never get so sober that I can't drink again. And just for short 10 years, I've seen that happen here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope to dear God that I stay as active as I am today, and that I never let that deadly complacency get in me where it winds me out of AA because I've been sober for a while. And I'm just glad to be here. I'm glad to be with my friends, and I'm glad to be at this meeting. My mother and father had nothing to do with me getting to AA. I had a good mom and dad. I had a great mom and dad. I didn't start thinking about my childhood until I came here. You know, I tell you the truth, I had them neatly tucked away for a long time, you know, and had them back there, and I really didn't start thinking about them until I got here. And when I did start thinking about them, though, I remembered that I did have a little Scandinavian mom, if there is such a thing as a little Scandinavian, and she loved diet pills. She loved that speed, you know, and I could always find, you know, if I ever wanted any love or affection, my mom loved those diet pills, you know, and I knew if I ever wanted any love or affection, I could find Mom sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage around 4 a.m, you know. or you can hear her raking the neighbor's yard around 5 a.m, you know, and just a busy lady, you know. At that time, they came out with gas-powered engines, you know, and she had this damn edger, and she'd get that edger going, you know, and get that, you know, just eyes and sparks, you know, going down the street. And and it was working. Hell, she was, you know, she was down to a stick, you know, but a great lady. She loved me well, she was, I wouldn't hang around my mom and dad if they weren't my parents, you know, but they were there and so were I, so, you know, my dad loved to drink. I mean, I didn't notice much about my dad, but I noticed that he loved to drink, you know, and he was a refinery worker. And when my dad would get drunk, he was a window climber. He was either sneaking in and out of the window or trying to sneak out, you know. And it was always in my bedroom that I could hear him sneaking in or out. I could feel his foot on my chest as he's coming in or out, you know. And it was hard to have respect to the old man who didn't have keys to his own home. I thought that was kind of weird, you know. But he snuck in there one night, and I said, "Jesus, Dad, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know? She's up anyway. She's going to be up. Up there buzzing around, you know. She probably can make you a set with her teeth to grind you out a little set there, you know. Get me a set, you know." And I'm in the middle. I got this younger sister who's a baby. She's getting all the attention from my mom. I got an older sister who is just incredible. She's sociable. She's well-mannered. She's just perfect, you know. And that's kind of hard to be around somebody like that when you're a loser, you know, and really makes the guy look bad, you know. And I'm stuck in the middle, and I'm sure I got weird stamped on my forehead. And at that time in my life, I'm doing everything all the other little kids are doing, you know. They seem to be getting a satisfaction out of every day going to school and playing Little League and doing all that stuff, you know. And I'm doing the same thing, and I'm coming home empty, you know. I've always remembered thinking about me and how I felt. I've always thought about me and how I felt, you know, and I remember doing that at that age, you know, and that there's got to be more to life than this. You know, I'm coming home with that little, it's just not enough, you know, and I guess around the time I was about 9 years old, my dad come into my room and he told me that I was going to have a baby brother. He says, Mom's going to have a baby, you're going to have yourself a kid brother. Boy, and that out the imagination, I started planning for that little kid brother. I started rolling up my glove and saving up my baseball cards, thinking about how me and that kid brother are going to go out there and we're going to play Little League and go to the drag races and Pop Warner football and maybe eventually beat up those two sisters. I don't know, you know. But I started planning, you know, and it was nice to focus on something like that. And then came time for my mom to go to the hospital and have the baby. My dad came back and said, my baby sister or my baby brother died. I don't remember having any type of wonderment or anything about, geez, how's mom feeling? Is there anything I can do? I did something that I was going to do to this day. I went right past temper tantrum into rage like that. And I remember yelling at that old man and going into just a rage and screaming and yelling and telling him the only thing I could hear was that he promised me. You promised me. And from that point on, I've been slowly building a wall, and I put the last brick in a wall that was going to come between me and my family until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why I was building it, but I was building it. And that was the last brick. That's all I needed. That's all I needed. And I became a window climber. I started sneaking out of my house. I felt more a part of the streets at midnight than I did around my own dinner table at 5 p.m. or my own family's breakfast table, you know, and I started sneaking. I started climbing out of those windows. Every now and then, me and my dad would pass in the same window. We'd give each other a high five, you know. How's mom doing? I don't know. I'm out of here, you know. Come the time I was 12 years old, I took my first drink of alcohol. There were four of us in the garage, and we passed around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, I did the same thing I saw my dad do. I could connect happiness with something. Not happy, ha-ha. I'm talking about that happiness that goes inside. And for the first time in your life inside, you know this is how you should be feeling. This is it. And then I puked, you know. But I never forgot that I could connect happiness with drinking. I never forgot that, you know. And I didn't head out to Skid Row that next day, but I never forgot that I could connect happiness with something. And that wasn't my first time I got drunk. You see, I'd been sneaking in and out of my dad's thermos for a long time. I'd been nipping at that port wine and that 102 beer for a long time. But that was the first time I'd done it with other guys, and it made it all right. It made it all right. No longer did I need any little goals for my life. No longer was it necessary for me to wonder what I was going to be when I grow up. No longer was it necessary for me to think about what I'm going to be when I grow up or graduate or play sports. Because whenever I felt odd or out of sorts, I could connect happiness with something, and I got it, you know. Come time to go into high school, everybody has a peer group. I hear people all the time say they come into Alcoholics Anonymous and they drank because of peer pressure. My peers didn't even know I was a peer. They didn't even know I was out there, you know. And I tried hanging around the surfers for a while, and it seems like all they did is whine about the weather and the waves, and I get enough of that at home, you know. And come the summer after my freshman year, I found a group of people that made me feel more a part of life than any, just as much as the people did in AA. I found a group of people where there was camaraderie, and there was brotherhood, and there was unity, and there was love. And that was the lowriders. And I loved the lowriders. And I loved, the first thing I loved about them was what we did with our hair. We used to get our hair up real high. It looked like a tumbleweed, man, you know. And we'd drive around, we'd listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. And God, it wasn't about 2 weeks ago at work, I was listening to the Four Tops in my truck and I started sinking down in the damn thing, you know. I mean, I loved the way it was making me feel. I had a little Mexican girlfriend named Lupi, and she used to curl her hair up real high. She used to get these soup cans, sometimes the stuff's still in them, you know. Curl up her hair real high, you know, and I'd eat those reds, and we'd drink that gin, and we'd go bounce around wondering what the hell you're staring at. What are you looking at, you know? What are you looking at, man? I had a white Town Crab t-shirt and black Crisco pants up to here. I had a hairdo out like that and pointed shoes 8 inches long that you could see before I did when I turned a corner, you know? She'd get up her eyes, and she'd paint her eyes real black and get her hair up real high and button her sweater backwards, and we'd bounce out there wondering what the heck you're looking at, you know? I know what you're looking at. You're looking at two of the funniest people I've ever seen in my life. I see them today, man. And, man, everything I was taking was working. Every shot of gin and every red and everything I was taking was working, man. It was working good, you know? Sometimes, I think in your sophomore of your year in high school, they have a driver's education class, and it was my turn to drive. So usually you've got the biggest coach in the world driving with you, you know, and the coach says, Thomas, your turn to get in the car. So I get my hair and I get in the car, you know, and I got these three Mexican girls in the back seat, and all I can see is their hot, you know, their eyes and hair out of the rearview mirror. They look like they're looking through a bush, you know, and we go driving around, and the coach pokes me, and he says, hey, you're doing pretty good, man. He says, why don't you pull into the Jack in the Box? I want to buy everybody some Pepsi. Well, what this guy don't know is 15 minutes before class, I took four of what they then call Tylenol. And these things are great, man. And these things come on, and my ears are ringing, and I start sweating, you know, and I can't hear, and I start, you know, I'm talking to the guy, and it goes, you know, and he said, pull in there and talk to the puppet and order some Pepsi. And I'm trying to hone in on it. I can't see the dang thing, you know, and I could just, can I have your order, please? So I start aiming for the voice, you know, and I'm going to hone in on that thing, you know, and I run over the puppet, you know, and can I have your order, please? And I want to talk to the puppet, you know, I want to ask him to come out and drive, you know, come on out of there and drive, you know. Cops come and they pull me out of the car, you know, and the three girls are crying. The coach got a worried look. They throw me on the hood of the car. They shatter my hair all over the parking lot, you know. And I can't drive till I'm 30, you know. So now I'm riding shotgun. I'm 120 pounds soaking wet, you know, and every now and then I'll take a shot of that gin, and I'll look out that rearview mirror of the car, and I'll put my arm on the hood of the car and press it down to make it look big so you don't mess with me, you know. And, you know, everything I was taking was working. And that don't make me alcoholic. None of that makes me alcoholic. But you could not tell me that the life I was living was not the normal one. You see, that was the only life I ever knew that made me feel that good. You know, and around 1969, everybody's going places. Some of my friends are going to Vietnam, and some of my friends are going to, they're turning hippie and going to Big Sur, and some of them are going to Wayside and Chino. I got people going all over the place, you know, and I wonder what I'm going to do with my life. So I take all my knowledge and my education, and I go to Phoenix. And there's not a... Yeah, that's about the size of it, you know. There's not a big call for blonde lowriders in Phoenix, you know, to this day, you know. And I'm up there on North Central and Buckeye Road at the Apache Motel. I'm on the third floor up there, and I'm drinking that old English, and I'm just... You know, what the heck am I going to do, you know? What's going on here? And I'm just lost. And I start selling my girlfriend to support some of my habits down at the bars down there. And then I start drinking that old crow, and I start robbing my connection and working out. I start drinking that old crow later on, and I start writing prescriptions. I start writing prescriptions for Tucanol and Nembutal and Tuinol and Obertrol. You name it all. You know, I wrote it all, you know. Damn near took it all, too. And they put me away for a couple of years in Phoenix, and I come out of there bound and determined that what I just went through, you can chalk it up to growing up. Now, what I just went through, you can chalk it up to being a teenager. And I come out to California, and I got these two voices in the back of my head. I got my old man's voice telling me, you're never going to amount to nothing, you punk. You're going to hang around those gangs, and you're always going to be a loser. I got my mom's voice on the other side telling me, you're always going to be a loser, Larry. You're never going to change. And they're both right. They're both dead right. And the thing that's happening to me is why I'm in this room right now. The thing that starts happening to me in 1972 is why I'm in this room right now. It stopped working. And you hear that all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it confused me when I was new. Because people would say, I drank and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then there were some people that say, I drank, it stopped working, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not me. When it stopped working, I become obsessed. Now I'm real concerned to get this thing to work again. Now I'm overly concerned. I'm real concerned because this thing ain't working now. And now I become obsessed to find a happy drunk I can no longer find. It says control and enjoy our drinking. I ain't thinking about controlling the amount. I'm trying to control that happy spot. And the harder I try to find it, the more it eludes me, and I can't find it. And I start out just to find the spot. And I'm scared because when I'm sober, I think about just finding that spot. I know I can find it. If I get the right kind of combination of the things in me, I know I can find it. And I'm obsessed to find a spot I'm no longer going to find. Maybe if I have some reds and wine, maybe if it's some heroin and some vodka, maybe some cocaine and gin, I've got to find a spot. Why am I obsessed with that spot? Because in 1967, it worked real good. In the back of that Chevy, bouncing around with Loopy and Poncho, all those things, that thing was working real good. And I know I can get it to work like that. Because it worked once. And that illusion drove me nuts. And in 1974, my probation officer doesn't know what to do with me. So he sends me to Camarillo for a couple months. And I'm in there for 4 months, and then 6 months, and then 9 months. And then 13 months later, I come out of there with every reason why I should drink. And they told me I'd be better off if I did. They said people like me don't conduct themselves out there without some kind of mood-altering chemical in them. And I lasted a couple months, and I'm being locked up in county jail for being publicly intoxicated, violation of probation, and I'm coming out of Wayside. And I'm at the South Bay Courthouse in Torrance in 1975. And I'm in the holding tank, and I hear them saying they're pulling guys for Wayside. They're pulling guys for Tehachapi. They're pulling guys for Chino. They're pulling guys for AA. Thomas, you're going to AA. And a Scottish man comes up there. His name's Alex. He has a patch on. He says, "Aye, lad." He says, "You're coming with me. You're going to AA." And I figured, well, here we go. Another trip across the desert, you know, to AA land, you know. I'm not chained to anybody. I'm not in a black and white car. I'm in a little lime green Plymouth, and I'm with the Scottish man, and he takes me 4 blocks away from this courthouse to the TLC Club in Torrance. He takes me to the Torrance Alano Club. And Alano, what is this, a kind of Samoan bar, you know? It's an Alano Club, you know? And I walk into this club, you know, and he introduces me to a man named Singin' Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and a little lady named Moose. And I says, "What in the hell am I doing here?" You know, I just left a group of people like that, you know. Little Moose came up to me and she said, "I've been expecting a miracle." And I says, "I bet you have, Moose. I have no doubt in my mind, you know." Contessa, this big transvestite, comes swooping up on me and she says, "I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." I said, "I don't think so." I don't understand. Scared the heck out of me, and I took one look around that room and I thought, if that's alcoholics, I must not be one. And if that's the effect of that little blue book, I'm not sure I want to dabble in this stuff, you know. Adios, and I'm out of here. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. On a regular basis, and that don't make me nothing. That don't give me status in AA. That don't give me anything but a firm belief in that book and my lethal disease that I have. It makes me nothing here. It does do nothing. There's no status here. And I came in and out on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk. 60 days and get drunk. 90 days and get drunk. The longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I was on heroin. And I wonder why I wasn't having a spiritual experience. And every time I came back, I was different. And every time I came back, I was sincere. And every time I came back, I was desperate. And you people were there. And Alcoholics Anonymous became another place for me to use. I approached Alcoholics Anonymous like I did everything else in my life. Why would I approach it any different? I came in here trying to half measure it. I came in here trying to cheat and get the goodies and do all that stuff and act as if. I approached everything in life that way. Me and you could add 10 more pages to Ad Infinitum in chapter 3. 10 more pages going to asylums, going to sanitariums, going to AA. To prove you were? No, to prove that I wasn't. I couldn't imagine life without drinking. I had to be able to drink again. I knew I could. And in 1980, I'm over at the Don Hotel. I'm on the third floor. And at this time in my life, there's a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who's really been doing his 12-step work. I mean, this guy's always there. He's around. He's taking me to meetings. And he's just there. And it just bugs me sometimes. And it's a Tuesday, and it's 10 in the morning. And I hear this, "Jesus, who's that?" "Larry, it's Don. It's this guy from AA, you know? I didn't even call him, and he's coming over, you know?" And he's got this newcomer with him, and they come into my apartment, my little room there, and I got a PM bourbon bottle cut in half. And he says, "Man, what are you doing? What are you doing, Larry?" He says, "You had 15 days. You were going to be a janitor with the city of Lomita. There's some hope for you new guys, you know?" "Man, what's going on?" And I took a shot off that PM bourbon bottle, and I told him, I said, "Don, you've been really trying your best and stuff." And I remember taking a shot off that bottle and telling him, "I don't want what you have. I don't want what you got. If I ever get that bad, I'll come and get it. Now get the heck out of my room and let me do what I want to do." You know, and in the moment that I said that, it struck a chord in the back of my neck. It shot me back to 1967 when me and my old man are wrestling around in the garage. I'm loaded up on gin and reds, and I'm telling my old man to get off my back, quit nagging me. Who cares if I'm selling dope at school? Let me do what I want to do, old man. And I'm fighting my dad, and my sisters are crying, and my mom's crying. They're pulling me off my father. It reminds me of 1972 when I'm over at mom's house, which is where macho men go where there's no place to go. I'm on mom's couch, and I wake up at 3 in the morning with those panics. And I can't find my old Cole bottle, and I go searching for it, and I can't find it. And I make enough noise, and my mom comes down the hallway, and she says, "Honey, what's wrong?" I said, "Don't you, honey, what's wrong me?" And I start slapping my mom around, telling her to let me do what I want to do. Go get me another bottle or I'll kill you. to wake up the next morning to see that I drank it all and put it in the trash. Let me do what I want to do reminds me of my friend in Phoenix, who's 10 feet away from me, and I'm sober, and he's drowning, and the only thought I have is when he's gone, I get his dope. Let me do what I want to do is why I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous right now. Me doing what I want to do for as long as I can stand it, nobody going to tell me what to do. It'll be a cold day in hell before I get another man a cup of coffee. It'll be a cold day in hell before I come in here and clean up ashtrays and put up seats. Nobody going to take away my right to drink. I may be a loser, but you ain't going to take away my right to drink. I got to have it. And all that went by me in about 20 seconds is the only answer to life left my room. And for 2 years, I'm stuck with the memory of this bald-headed carpenter. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll tell you one thing. You may leave us, but we will never leave you. Because somehow, someday, when you least expect it, and you're curled up in your car, and you're curled up in your room, you're going to think about that goof in Santa Monica with the tie on Wednesday night. Right when you get ready to cap the seal, I'll pop right in there. Or somebody in here will pop right in there. And I'd panhandle all day to get that little bottle of port wine, and I'd curl up in my room, and I'd go to take a drink, and there's Don. I go, what the heck's he doing here, you know? I haven't thought about him all day, you know? I didn't think about him that much when I was hanging around him, you know? And I start thinking about all these goofy people in AA, and I couldn't get them out of my mind. And for 2 years, I'm stuck with the memory of you. I can't get drunk, and I can't get sober, and I got enough self-pity to keep me on the street to show you how bad I am, to show you what you've done. Look at me. I couldn't even get up off the street to go get a job, and I'm stuck on the streets down there in Wilmington and Long Beach. And on May 2nd, 1982, I reached that point where I think all of us have to reach when we take that first step, and sometimes I think it's just, people think all I got to do is raise their hand, and there's a point when we come to that conclusion in our mind where we've conceded to our animal. There, you look at yourself like you never have before. You see yourself like you never have before, and you see yourself with the clearest eyes, and you see what a loser and what a lost case of humanity you are, and that you better get some help. Because it ain't getting any better. And there was one thing I couldn't deny, that while I was going in and out of those meetings, those people were staying sober. And I get up the phone and I call central office, and who do I get? I get Don. Don, this is Larry. I'm ready to come back to A&A. I'm down here at the Mission in Wilmington. Would you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He says, no, you son of a bitch. You know where we are. You know what we got. If you want to get sober, you get your rusty rear down here yourself. I'm tired of chasing after you. Jesus, he used to be so nice, you know. And then he hung up. And for the first time in my life, I took an action for my sobriety. For the first time in my life, I walked from Wilmington to Torrance to show up at that meeting. And I showed up at that meeting, and it was a Thursday night meeting. It was a participation meeting. And I got there at 3 in the afternoon, and I shook it off, and I had the shakes, and I had the hallucinations here, and I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stood up Thursday night, and that was my night. That was my night. Because I became ready to take direction from people I didn't even like. I began to take direction from people who I'd been mocking, who I'd been using. And I've come to believe in one thing, that that book is right. I don't believe a lot of things. I don't know a lot about God, but I believe in that book. That book is becoming more clear to me the longer that I stay sober. That thing is just ringing things in me today that it's just unbelievable. And I come back to that meeting, and I stood up, and I was no longer a guest, and I felt like a member. And for 2 years, I was crazy. Because now I'm stuck with a difference that I just can't shake. You see, I'm a phony. I've always had a little image or something to hide behind. I've always been a doper or a loser or something, and now I've got the worst image. Now I've got a difference that I can't shake. You see, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and then 2 years at a club, I become a club guru, which takes about 2 years, I think. And you know where all the dances are, and you know some phrases, and you know you put on your AA face. Half hour before meeting time, you put your AA mask on. Half hour after meeting time, you take your mask off. You know how to shake hands and pour coffee and forget names with the best of them. And that's what I was, and I was dying, because now you know what my difference is? I'm a flipper. You don't understand. I need a flipper sponsor. I need a flipper book. I need flipper meetings. I need a pair of slippers, for Christ's sake. Get me out of here. You see, I was so prideful in what I used to be like. I was so prideful in what I used to be like and what I've accomplished, and that there's no further work necessary. And I'd sit in the back of these rooms and I'd hear speakers go, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles, and now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you. You know, hey, man, I came in with that guy, you know. What the heck's going on here? And I tried desperately to work an honest program dishonestly. God, I tried desperately to do that. And at 2 years sober, I'm sitting at this club, and a man comes in there and told me what I was. He says, you're a loser. You're a user of people. You're a loser. You're an AA pimp. He says, there's some literature being thrown around here, being tossed around. It says, Unity, Service, and Recovery. He says, there's also another triangle that's being tossed around. It's called Homework and Play. He says, what are you doing when you leave here, pal? What do you like at home? What do you like at work? What do you like in the neighborhood? Are you taking what you get in here out there? Are you trying to drag that crap out there? You see, Alcoholics Anonymous had to shake me from the most secure thing I had, and that was my old lifestyle. I could not imagine me acting any other way. What does that have to do with drinking and not drinking? And I guarantee you, what I do in between meetings constitutes whether I'm going to stay sober or not. What I do when I leave you is going to constitute if I'm ever going to drink. The way I behave has everything to do with me drinking. And I had to follow that man. And that man's my sponsor. His name's Johnny, and my home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower. And it's great to be in the biggest meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's nothing like the best. And I'm in the best. Thank you. And I followed that man. And those are the two most important things in my life, not because of who they are, but because of what they did for me. They introduced me to a program called Alcoholics Anonymous in its entirety. They taught me about traditions that are to be applied at home and in my personal life. They talked to me about sponsoring people. I hear all the time people talking about these amends steps. And a couple years ago, we were sitting in a workshop, and some guy was saying, yep, I put my name on top of the list. And I went feverishly through that book. I went feverishly through the 12 and 12, and nowhere in there does it say we put our name on top of that list. And I showed my sponsor, you know, it ain't in there. Now, isn't that just like an alky? Isn't that just like some alky to run destruction for 20 or 30 years, and when it's time to get a reprieve, who wants it first? I do. Get me up there first. You know? You told me how I get forgiveness. You told me that there's an amends that have to be made. And this is some damage that I have to make amends to, and to get out there and make those amends and start sponsoring people. Start giving this thing away. And for a little over 10 years, that's what I've been trying to do. Thank God for a sponsor and structure of a home group. You see, I'm no big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm no big deal. I'm a coffee maker. I'm a coffee maker and a cookie lady. That's all I do. Pastry check. You know. That's all I am, man. I am no big deal here. And that's exactly where I'm to be the most useful, is when I'm no big deal and I'm just one other alkie. That's where I'm at my best. And you taught me how to be there. You taught me about respect. My sponsor has taught me about respect. He taught me for respect for a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I take that respect that I have in here, and maybe I can take it home and maybe respect that lady that I'm with. And maybe that I can eventually show respect to a boss. I never had respect for anything. You people taught me that. You know, I used to think that if I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous, it would shield me from life's little bullets. And what it does is stick you smack dab in the middle of life, and you better have a program, because they don't care. They don't care how many chips you have. They don't care how many cakes you're taking, how many people you sponsor. You know? Alcoholics Anonymous is the longest thing I've ever done against my will in all my life. Everything about it goes against the grain. And everything about it is after a fact. After I take the action, I get the result. See, I'm part of the divinely dissatisfied. Well, I'm still coming around hoping one day it'll kick in. And for close to 10 years, I've lived the best life I've ever had. I lived the best life I've ever had. And that's because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous and sharing my life with other people. And it's been a heck of a year. This has been a heck of a year for me. I mean, business failures and divorces and stuff like that. And I tell you, there are some people in this room tonight who have literally saved my life and kept me in Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. They have stuck me in Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. There are people who have literally saved my life in this room. You know? because I didn't know how to share with anybody who I wasn't sponsoring. I didn't know how to share with anybody who wasn't my sponsor. I didn't know how to share with my friends. I didn't know how to tell my buddies I'm hurting. I didn't know how to tell the guys that I'm riding around with who I don't sponsor. I didn't know how to be one among many. You see, I had the god-awful pride that I get after 5, 6, 7 years, that I'm supposed to be feeling a certain way, and if I feel anything but that, I can't show it. God, did I ever block out some love? God, did I ever block out the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous by doing that? And you taught me how to do that, that it's all right. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I welcome you to a way of life that is beyond your imagination, you know, and I always wanted to be a part of something. I've always wanted to be a part of something, and I feel a part of life, and I feel like I have a usefulness and a purpose, and it's because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. If you knew, I wish you desperation. I hope you're so desperate that you do things that you don't even believe will apply to you, and may God be with you. You know, and I don't know a lot about God and stuff like that, but I know this, that if me and you who are so full of defects and sin, if we do the best for our fellow man and be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, just think what God, who is all good, will do for us. I want to thank you for letting me be here tonight.